welcome to Aspire. I'm your host, Gregory Penn. It is Saturday morning, March the 21st, 2015, and I'm very grateful to be with you as I have some really, really interesting questions. I have collected them, I will admit, over a period of many months, and I just wanted to put them together in one program, and sometimes I have to wait a while before I can actually put them together in a format that I think is helpful to you. And I want to thank these three people who have been so gracious, so kind, and so generous as to offer these questions. They are magnificent, and I think you will find them helpful as well. I want to thank my sponsors. It is only through your sponsorship that this radio program, my Aspire TV programs, and everything that you see on our website at aspire.org is available. And I want to thank all of you. It allows me to do all sorts of hospice work and other things that serve humankind. And it is only through your generosity that these programs exist. And I wish to thank all of you for your loving kindness. I really do. It's a very important thing. Let's get to the first question by Raymond. What is mind? What is it? How does it work? Where's its place in our spirituality? I don't understand. Raymond. Raymond, yours is a particularly interesting question. What is mind? Well, we use our minds in ways in which it is not really the authentic mind. The mind that we use, how we use the mind, is to rationalize our evils. That's really the way we use it. Now, the mind can be used for all sorts of things. It can be a gatherer of knowledge, and then taking that knowledge and using logic and reasoning to come to places of conclusions, whereby we understand what we're doing, how we're doing it, and why we're doing whatever we're doing. Knowledge is an interesting thing. People who use their minds to only gather knowledge are only as good as the last thing they can think. But for those who use their mind to become aware of knowledge, now knowledge being that of the sciences, possibly, it could be any part of understanding the logic of the science, we begin to use our mind in a different way. I like watching how people process everything through their mind. But to the pedestrian mentality of which most of us are a part, in the collective unconscious of which most of us live, we use our minds as our enemy. We don't use them well. We use our minds to define our fears and to try to escape our fearfulness. So we use our mind in a defensive posture, always trying to make our mind the, shall we say, division between ourselves and some unfortunate or unwanted emotional outcome. Our minds typically are connected, Raymond, to our emotionality. We're always using our minds to govern and to, so to speak, fulfill, find a way to fulfill our emotionality. And our emotions need constant attention. This is why if you turn on the TV, I really shouldn't be talking about this because I don't watch TV, but the effort we place on entertainment, the emphasis to be entertained has to go further and further. We like extremes. I was watching, I was watching a little bit of the Oscars the other night, a few weeks ago, and it was really interesting. just so interesting. The commercials they had. And then I finally turned it off, couldn't handle it anymore. How to get away with murder, things like that. Now, you don't think that that affects the way we use our mind, even if you're sitting there passively watching. Why would you watch that? I don't even understand that. Big numbers, I'm sure. They don't make TV programs without checking their numbers first, because it's all about the economics. But if you start to look at everything that I'm talking about with the mind, we find a way through the mind to rationalize the whole idea of watching a TV program like that and letting our mind sink down, 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 deeper and deeper and deeper into hate and fear. And this is what we call a lifetime. We put our butts in the Barca lounger and sit there and let hate and fear wash over us. And what does it say about us that seek to be entertained through hate and fear? What does that say about us? It's ugly. And that's what we do, and we never question it. People never question their emotionality. They only try to fulfill it or try to make it look a certain way where it is unavoidable. Oh, I couldn't help the way I felt. Couldn't help this. Couldn't help that. And that's how we use our minds. A lot of it has to do with genetics. A lot of it has to do with DNA. So depression and a lot of those kinds of things are often realized and experienced through genetics and DNA. And those are issues that we really need to take serious consideration for. I think they're very, very important. But there is something other than all of this. You ask me, what is the mind? Well, the way we use it, it isn't to say this is the mind. The mind is without definition. So I don't want you to sit there and think, Raymond, that whatever I say here is gospel, because it's not. What I'm saying is the way we use it, this is not to say this is what the mind is. The way we use it is to convert our fears and our hatreds into preferences in our life. I hate to say that, but it's true. And if you look at everything you think, you meet a person, it's emotional. They're sizing you up, sniffing your crotch to find out who you are, what you are, how important are you. All of this is emotional. And then where do I fit with this person, or how do I talk to this person? It's all about striking emotions. We want friendly emotions, or we want clever emotions, or we want them to think something of us. So we emotionally set into action something through our thoughts, our words, to make them believe, well, we're this and we're not that. And this goes on and on and on. Then you ask me this question. What is the mind's place in our spirituality? So, Raymond, when you and I are tired of this rigmarole of how we use our minds, when we no longer choose to use our mind as a way to enforce emotionality, there is something we call in Zen no mind. This is a mind that does not live in emotional preferences. This is a mind that is not seeking to consider, as Buddha said, what is good and bad, what is right and wrong. It is a mind that is watching, observing. It is not thinking, it is an observer. And when I am just observing, I am not thinking about what I'm observing. I am just observing. That is when something unique begins to happen, something beautiful. This is a meditative mind that you can take with you anywhere. It is cultivated through meditation, not being involved with our thoughts, not being enamored by them, not being placated by them because they're connected to our emotionality. Rather, we are just observing. And in this observation, we realize the bigger picture of our life. We realize that which is and that which ain't. And once you understand that, once that is clear to you, your mind and the function of it changes. You won't use it in ways that are derogatory towards your spirituality. And the way we use our minds now, everything is derogatory towards our spirituality. When you make a philosophy out of anything, when you say, this is what I believe in, you've become derogatory towards whatever it is you say you believe in. You say you believe in God? Well, if you do, if any of us do, then why do we live so godless? If you say you believe in love, why do you live so loveless? Why? Because our emotionality comes in, and it wants to tell you this and tell you that, and make this happen and make that not happen, whatever it is. That our preferences, we're always trying to overcome our emotional fears through the management of our emotionality through our thinking. But when you are done with that, when you and I no longer want this anymore, we see the futility of it, then another kind of mind can occur. A no mind. This is what we practice in Zen. And this is ultimately very important to your life. So Raymond, I hope that answers your question a little bit. You might want to sign up for my commentaries, podcast, videocast thing. There's a lot of teachings in there about cultivating another kind of mind, a new mind. And if you're willing to read these things and listen to them and watch my TV programs without preconceived thoughts and emotionalities, preconceived beliefs, you might be able to observe what I am teaching and drop into no mind. Wow. It is an amazing thing. And then meditate upon it, because that's really what it's all about. I hope this helps you, Raymond. Please forgive me. Namaste. It's really a great question. And, you know, I've saved this question for months, waiting for, you know, another question to kind of be in the genre of this, because it's very, very good question. I did. And here is one by Caesar. He does not tell me where he lives. What is it to be judgmental? I judge all the time, and I can't help it. What's wrong, Caesar? This is a great question. Caesar, if you knew how many times in my lifetime as a teacher I have been asked this question, or it is assumed that people understand the answer to it, you would probably be blown away. So allow me, first of all, most of us don't know the difference between discernment and judgment. If I am to judge someone, then I will look at them and think through whatever it is I see, that they are good or bad people. I will love them or I will not love them, based on what I interpret from them. Now, where does my interpretation come from? Well, it comes from my preferences, my genetics, my DNA. And should I fall to that and then be mesmerized that that is the ultimate truth of any given person or situation, then I am truly in error. And I have definitely fallen away from the truth and the light of it all. But if I can have discernment, the ability to look at something and see it for what it is, and not what I imagine it to be. If I can just observe, like I was saying here to Raymond, non-critically and non-judgmentally. In other words, to look at something, whether it be a person or a situation, and not judge it as this is bad and this is good. Just to observe it. Just to watch it. Just to recognize it. Now, If I want to put a value to that, that's where I make my mistake. Because in that value, I am going to say, this is better than that. And in saying that, I create within me a diversion. A diversion from seeing things for the way they really are and falling for what I believe they are. Let me give you an example. There's all sorts of racial prejudices in this world. Now, to you and to me, Caesar, this may seem strange and weird. I don't get it any more than most people, but I wasn't raised in the genetics and in the disposition of a society and a culture where I was raised and I was born into that had this as a disposition in thinking. I didn't have that. My parents were not like that at all. I never was like that, and it just never occurred to me, actually, to be honest with you, just never occurred. So for me to sit there and think, well, people who are prejudiced are idiots and terrible people would be just as bad as being prejudiced about whatever these people are prejudiced about. We don't seem to understand this in our culture, that being anti-racial is a prejudice in itself, and it can't be separated from the cause. It's like screwing for virginity. It just doesn't work. What I must see in my discernment is this. Oh, one is no better than the other. And in truth, if I am against a prejudice, I have become prejudiced. But if I see the futility of prejudice, both sides of it, and I recognize what it is, then I begin to see the emotionality of myself and what I am dealing with. And it has nothing to do with what they are dealing with. It is what I am dealing with. Oh, I have become racially prejudiced against being racially prejudiced. The discernment comes in seeing that there is no difference. But the change is this. To live beyond the confines of any prejudice, to simply love the core of every person you meet. To love that person as a, shall we say, divine rendezvous, a serendipitous meeting that has nothing at all to do with prejudice. Once you begin to enter into that ever so slightly, you will come into love for humankind. It is not being judgmental to see the futility of our judgments. I am not being judgmental when I see the futility of anything I am doing that is silly, unkind, unloving. That's not being judgmental. Being judgmental is when I would either ignore it and go on with it or condemn it because it isn't socially or politically correct. Both are prejudices. Both are judgments. Discernment allows you to see the difference between the two and then to no longer enter into that as a way of life. It is making our judgments a way of life that makes it so terrible. No one is what I believe them to be, good or bad, right or wrong. I have people that I dearly, dearly, dearly adore, but they have a dark side too, and they are foolish too, just like me. I have people that love me, but I am foolish at times. I make mistakes like anyone else does. I'm no better than anyone else. No, not at all. Does that make me a terrible person? Well, to some people it does. And to other people it's it doesn't matter. That's the way I live. It really doesn't matter. I only care about your well-being. So, Caesar, when you care about a person's well-being, you care about your own well-being. And you see that you can't help other people unless you help yourself. You have to love others as you love yourself and love yourself as you love others. In other words, their well-being must be more important to you than what they've done, what they've said, and the ignorances they ponder over or don't ponder over that they purport to this life. Love them all. That's just my little motto inside is just love them all. You know, accept where you find them and accept yourself where you find yourself. And when you have dropped this moralistic idea of right and wrong, good and bad, you'll be able to love them all. It won't have anything to do with color or race or creed or whatever. All that silly stuff. But you will discern. And discernment is very important. You want to call it judgment? I don't. Discernment is the ability to see the differences in things and to understand the nature of the genetics, the DNA, and even the way things work and not take it poisonally. Caesar, thank you for your beautiful question. I have waited to answer this question for weeks. Thank you for your patience. Please forgive me. Namaste. Whoever Caesar is, he's cool. Last question is from Roger. I don't get it. How does what you teach really help anyone? You never really lay anything out that helps us. So what do you do to help, as you say, humankind? Roger. Roger, I don't know. I'm a throwaway for people like you. People like you don't understand, so makes me valueless. What I am talking about here is not of any value to you, obviously, yet you listen and read and do the things you do. Come to my website and critique my TV programs and such. You don't seem to understand them, and yet a part of you is drawn to them. Now, is it because you think I'm easy pickings? That, criticizing me makes you feel good or makes you believe you're better than or something like that? Is that what it's all about? I don't know. I literally don't know because I don't know you. But I can tell you this, that if you will listen and you will try to drop whatever it is that is your value system for helping people, you might find that the things I am offering to you might be of service to some part of your life. If you look at the teachings of any great master from Buddha, Lao Tzu, even Jesus, what did they do? How did they help the world? Well, Jesus is the more popular one in the West. He didn't help anyone. We're still a mess. We're still doing all the ugly things we do. And we know what his teachings were, or at least we believe we do. I'm just going to just paraphrase that and gloss over it and assume that you understand living an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and judging your neighbor and all that other stuff that he taught. Just the simple things that, what good did that do? What good did that do? We're still doing all of that. Nothing has changed over the 2,000 some years that he lived. What good was he? The teachings I offer, the things that I am giving to you here, Roger, are not for the common person. They're for the person who is in the deep minority in this world. People who are not looking to see what they can get and how to get it. I will watch one of my colleagues doing a Sunday morning sermon, and it was so bad, I just couldn't believe it. And this person was appealing to the nature of their audience so they could make a living, get some money. Believe me, when I was teaching formally, if you didn't talk to what you're talking about here, a lot of people didn't see the relevance of what I was talking about. If you don't tell people how to get more and be more to get more, you're not going to get a good offering, and your days are numbered, because people are only interested in themselves and how to survive. That's as far as their intelligence goes. So you got to look at the bigger picture here, my friend. Roger, there's higher arts and higher sciences than survival. There really are. And should you ever become interested in that, then my message might have some meaning. But the fact that you keep coming back and watching my TV programs tells me something's brewing in you, and maybe you ought to consider reconsidering, if you know what I mean. Thank you for your beautiful question, Roger, and keep watching. Keep watching. Please forgive me. Namaste. If you have a comment, a question, or something, I might be able to be of service to you, and I would love to hear from you. Just come to this website at aspire.org, and at the top of the page, you will see contact. And if you just hit that and write me a question, I'd love to hear from you. If you're not on our sponsorship list and would like to hear the answer to your program, which most of you do, I will send you an MP3 of it so you can hear it. Okay? Have a wonderful day. Please forgive me. Namaste.